Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, Flooding and Finance. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening to WLRN. Roy Wright has a job title that is commensurate with his job responsibilities.
My formal title is Deputy Associate Administrator for Insurance and Mitigation.
Now, that's a mouthful, so there's a shorter version that spells out more clearly exactly what he does.
Usually, they refer to me as the director of the National Flood Insurance Program.
So he's the guy in charge of flood insurance for the United States. There really is no other position like that. There are people in charge of regulating other types of insurance, writing the rules for life insurance, car insurance, health insurance, for instance. But Roy Wright is the guy in charge of flood insurance for America's property owners and the American taxpayer. Unlike most insurance, it is the taxpayer who bears the financial risk of most flood insurance. After all, insurance is about risk transfer, paying an insurance premium to someone who takes the financial risk to pay you if damages are over a certain amount. That's how all insurance works at the heart. And in the case of flood insurance, since the late 1960s, it has been the federal government who takes on the risk of paying insured homeowners if the water rises too high. Now, in Florida, that's almost 1.8 million homeowners. Two out of every five flood insurance policies in Florida are in South Florida. So just how big is South Florida for flood insurance? One out of every eight flood insurance policies in the entire United States covers property here in South Florida, in Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, or Monroe counties. So when there's talk about how deep in debt the program is and whether or not Congress will continue the program before it's due to expire at the end of September, it's a conversation that directly impacts South Florida, its residents, probably their biggest investment, their homes, and our economy. Almost $200 billion worth of property in South Florida is protected by federally backed flood insurance. Molly Curry is one of those. Technically, she doesn't have flood insurance in her name, but her condo association in Fort Lauderdale does. In March, Molly got a letter from her mortgage company telling her she no longer needed to have flood insurance.
So it's a great neighborhood, and we're sitting on an L-shaped canal that leads out to the Intercoastal, which is where the Winterfest boat parade goes by. But we have guarded community. We have great recreational halls, so I love the area.
Now, it's federal law that most mortgages require the property to be covered by flood insurance if it is in certain flood zones. Odds are, if you have a conventional mortgage, you have to have flood insurance if you're in one of those zones. In Molly Curry's case, it is her condo association that has the insurance. But for reasons we'll hear later on in the program, it was reclassified out of a flood zone, allowing Molly's condo association to drop their flood insurance if it wants to.
Wow. How did this happen? Who made the decision? Is this going to lower my security costs? I mean, a lot of questions.
Now, we'll hear more from Molly coming up in the program, including her question to our Palm Readers project that sparked this program. She wanted to know,
who or what agency determines flood zones? How often are they updated, and what is the criteria to determine a flood zone?
But before we get to flood zones, flood insurance first. For hundreds of thousands of people in South Florida, it is a fact of life, whether they've been flooded or not. If you live in a certain type of flood zone and you have a mortgage, you probably are required to buy flood insurance. Consider this the property mortgage mandate when it comes to flood insurance. Now, the average premium in Florida is a little more than $500 a year. For that, homeowners get $250,000 of coverage for their buildings and another $100,000 of coverage for all the stuff in your house. Non-residential buildings can buy up to $500,000 of coverage. But like most averages, that $500 average premium for flood insurance in Florida, it doesn't really capture the range of prices. Thousands of properties are grandfathered into low rates that don't fully price the risk they face of high waters. Now, these are homes and buildings that were built decades ago and started buying flood insurance before flood zone maps were first created in the 80s and then updated. As long as these homeowners have had flood insurance before the newest maps came into effect and continue buying that insurance, they get a discounted rate. Now, this grandfathering can save property owners 50% or more off their yearly flood insurance premiums. That can be several thousand dollars per year. But it increases the financial risk for those taking the risk, the American taxpayer. And the National Flood Insurance Program is swimming in red ink. Now, this is where Roy Wright comes in. Remember him?
The full official title is Deputy Associate Administrator for Insurance and Mitigation.
No one uses that except when it's in my signature block. Usually they'll just refer to me as the director of the National Flood Insurance Program.
Wright inherited a national flood insurance program that is seriously underwater and has been for years. He has been the flood program's boss for 2 years now, but its financial troubles date back more than a decade to the historic hurricane season of 2005. Still to come, we talk with the flood insurance program boss about keeping the system afloat.
I want folks to know for certain that if they have a policy with the National Flood Insurance Program and they experience a flood loss, we will pay.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, Flooding and Finance. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The 2017 hurricane season officially begins in less than 2 weeks. It brings with it the end of the dry season, though Mother Nature doesn't always respect us imposing a calendar on her. The first named storm, Arlene, appeared in April. It was only the second time a tropical storm formed in April. Arlene did not pose a threat to land as she was more than 1,500 miles out to sea. Now, the beginning of the storm season brings with it the usual and necessary reminders of being prepared to weather a storm, but also the financial preparation necessary. And today we're talking about flood insurance. Florida is home to more flood insurance policies than any other state by a factor of three. And even though Florida is most prone to hurricanes, it is not the state that has pushed the National Flood Insurance Program into the red and kept it there for more than a decade. Roy Wright is the director of the program, which is under the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
We have a program by which close to 80% of our policies are actuarially based, which is to say the price that they're paying is commensurate with their risk. We've got a little more than 20% of our policies that by statute, by law, we're required to give discounts to. And when we give those discounts, that is what opens up the aperture and causes the financial vulnerabilities that get so much time and attention. So today, we're up about $25 billion in debt. But that debt is entirely attributed to the direction that Congress has given us in terms of how to pay claims. Almost all that debt I can attribute to two major events. And those events are Katrina and Sandy, and those events hit places where there's a very high concentration of those discounted policies.
When you talk about 20% of the policies being essentially underpriced for the risk that they present in the case of the National Flood Insurance Program to the American taxpayer, you know, there's the old management adage that 80% of your time as a manager is focused on 20% of your challenges. Seems like this holds true for flood insurance policies.
Yes, that does.
And so why is there such a high concentration of those subsidized insurance plans in those locations?
You know, so the history of grandfathering and discounts deal with where homes were already constructed as communities came into the National Flood Insurance Program. Some came in 30 years, 40 years, some of them as much as 45 years ago. And so you deal with concentrations of those grandfathered or discounted policies. Frankly, I have them all across the country. Yet we have those concentrations, and I saw them play out in Louisiana and in some of the areas affected by Sandy.
Now, those are not areas where flood insurance policies are concentrated by number of policies. It's really in the state of Florida that is your biggest geographic concentration.
My biggest geographic concentration is Florida, but Louisiana and the Northeast also have quite a number as well.
So when you talk about the 20% of policies within the National Flood Insurance Program essentially contributing to this $25 billion deficit, and some of that, a big part of that, related to how Congress wants to continue to subsidize and grandfather those policies. How do you manage that financially as Florida, for instance, is looking at another storm season beginning in a matter of weeks?
So today, I look and price the risk, either based on the actuarial rate or the discount that Congress tells me to put into place. And we write a series of one-year contracts. And so I look at my expected losses for a year, and we set pricing based on that. So I collect premium on an ongoing basis, as well as a reserve fund assessment that every policy player, every policy holder will pay into. Collectively, that gives me about $3.5 billion worth of ability to pay claims per year. If I use those dollars, I have ways to use Treasury authorities. If I don't use all of those dollars, they would carry over into dealing with claims that would come in the following year.
But the program has such a big hole because of the Katrina year in 2005 and Superstorm Sandy in 2012. Is there any ability to put premium increases in place in order to begin to fill that hole like a standard for-profit insurance company would?
Right. So I think the way we would look at that is from a pure premium perspective, I'm always going to focus on the risk of that year. You then can look at ways by which you deal with assessments or surcharges to fill out those other expenditures. But at its root, the actuaries are always going to come back to the risk to that property in that year.
And is that the proper way to look at it, given the experience in 2005 and 2012?
I think it is. I think that, you know, clearly there are places where those discounts that have been mandated by Congress put us in a vulnerability from a financial perspective. But Congress also directed me how to pay those claims. And what I want folks to know for certain that if they have a policy with the National Flood Insurance Program and they experience a flood loss, we will pay, and we will fulfill every bit of the contract that we sign with them for and indemnify against the losses that are in the coverages for the policy.
And this is a big difference for those that have private insurance for contents or fire or property insurance, in that it is the wherewithal of the insurance company to be able to make good on those claims. In this case, those claims have the implicit backing of the federal government and the federal treasury, and thus the taxpayer. Is that fair to say?
That is indeed fair to say.
In 2012, the year of Superstorm Sandy, there was a legislative effort to eliminate some of those discount premiums and some of those grandfathered clauses. And those folks that were involved with those policies did see premiums go up only for a year or so, because in 2014, Congress then repealed those efforts.
That's correct.
What has been the impact since 2014 of the continuation of the subsidy and the grandfathering of these lower rates of premium that are not commensurate with the flood risk?
Well, I think it puts us in a position by which the revenue that is brought in a given year is not entirely based on actuarial principles. Again, the 80% are actuarially priced. That 20%, we're going to follow the law. That's what we're required to do. I think as you look at the preceding efforts in 2012 as well as 2014, and as Congress looks at reauthorization this summer, I do think that you're going to see a continued attention to getting us to a point by which a homeowner does understand their risk, and they understand it at a price point. So one of the things the 2014 law told me to do under a title they called, quote unquote, clear communication, is if you're receiving one of those discounts, either grandfathered or subsidized policy, we are required to tell you what the price point would be if you were fully priced at an actuarial basis. Sometimes that can be specific. Sometimes it's going to be a range or band because we don't have all the data on that structure. But I think that was a step in the right direction. Even in the 2014 year, they lay out a glide path to see increases on those discounted policies, although they did it in a way that slowed that rate down quite a bit.
How underpriced is flood insurance for those policies that are grandfathered in or subsidized at lower premiums?
There's not a simple answer to that question. It truly varies from structure to structure.
Can you give us a percentage range of what that underpricing looks like?
Really, and I understand where you're trying to go with the line of questioning. The nature of the grandfathering Could have a few hundred dollars worth of difference. It could have a couple thousand dollars worth of difference. It really requires us to move from grandfathered, which is to say we just take it the way it was when you came in without asking any more questions, and pivoting to a view that says we're going to look at the specific risk. We're going to underwrite the specific risk at your structure.
Broadly, as you're doing the financial planning for the program, essentially this fiscal year, next fiscal year, how much more could the program cost? Are you planning for the program to cost in payouts versus what it's going to collect in premiums?
So working with my actuaries, we model out a normal loss year. And if you look across the history of the program, the years that we have borrowed have been very few. You obviously can point to Katrina. You can point to Sandy. There was a small amount done following Ike in 2008, and there was a small amount done this past year.
And because of Matthew.
Matthew contributed to it. We paid out more than $4 billion in claims in 2016 across 83,000 families who received payments as a result of their insurance contracts with us.
But it was not Florida that accounted for a lot of those insurance claims last year. For the year ending in September, before Matthew scraped the Florida East Coast, we were seventh in the nation in the number of flood insurance claims filed, even though there is a far greater number of policies here than any other state. Louisiana, Texas, and North Carolina had the most insurance claims. For the calendar year last year, which does include Matthew, 8,600 flood insurance claims were filed in Florida, with $238 million in claims paid out. That's an average payout of almost $28,000. Back to Roy Wright, director of the National Flood Insurance Program.
The overall cost of Matthew to the program was about a little more than $700 million. The Florida portion of that was $230 million. All this sits in the context of a loss year of 2016, which was the third largest loss year in the program's history, only behind Katrina and Sandy. And about a little more than half of that, $2.4 billion of it, I can attribute to the Louisiana inland floods of August 2016. The balance of it is between Matthew and a series of events across the country where I would see some very small ones, but a whole series of them that are $200 to $300 million apiece.
Yeah, those will add up quickly. In the year 2016, without a significant hurricane, a significant superstorm, how would you gauge 2016 as a measure of regularity or an atypical year for the flood insurance program, financially speaking?
We sit down, we work with modelers and look at a whole range of expected losses in any given year. And, you know, the 50 percentile, the over-under on that, is probably a $2.5 billion claim year for the program. But we would model out and see events. Frankly, Katrina is an expected event. Sandy is an expected event. The inland flooding we saw in August of 2016 would be an expected event. And that's what the actuaries do. They look across a whole range of expected events.
And right, and those get baked into your financial forecast. So back to the original calculation, what does the kind of income statement, essentially the balance sheet, look like for the program for this fiscal year?
So I'm at risk any year of exceeding the need to pay out claims above my retained premium. I look at years like 2013, 14, and 15, and we stayed in the black. I look at a year like 2012 with Superstorm Sandy. I look at a year like 2016 with the collection of events, including the Louisiana event in August, and we exceeded the premium revenue.
Mr. Wright, what kind of financial drag on the program are the interest payments owed on the debt that has been incurred because of Katrina and Sandy in years past?
The servicing of the debt has a substantial impact on us. In this year of 2017, my interest payments will be almost $400 million.
And does the program actually make those payments?
Yes, sir. So we make those payments to the Treasury. I make payments twice a year to the Treasury. So this year, about $400 million. Over the last dozen years, we have paid $4 billion in interest.
So over the past 12 years, that's $4 billion of payback for borrowing to pay for past floods. Still to come, just as hurricane season begins, so too does the effort to renew the flood insurance program before it expires at the end of September.
I hear a clear commitment to a multi-year on-time reauthorization of this program.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening to WLRN. Today's program was inspired by a couple of things: the calendar and a listener contribution to our Palm Readers Project. That is our public power journalism project where you can submit questions you want our news reporters to explore. You can add your question at WLRN.org/palmreaders. What about the South Florida economy are you curious about? Let us know. Molly Curry of Fort Lauderdale sent us these questions.
Who or what agency determines flood zones? How often are they updated, and what is the criteria to determine a flood zone?
Behind Molly's question is a government-backed insurance program that dates back to 1968. It predates the government agency that actually runs it today, FEMA, by a decade. Private insurance companies could not make any money offering flood insurance, so the federal government stepped in with the goal of providing coverage while working with communities to reduce the risk of catastrophic flooding. Now, Congress first started taking it seriously after the 1965 hurricane season and the devastation caused by Hurricane Betsy. That storm was a major hurricane as it moved through the Upper Keys before going through the Gulf of Mexico and turning north into Louisiana, coming ashore near New Orleans. She was the first billion-dollar hurricane. Betsy was the birth of Congress seriously considering flood insurance. She also led the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to build flood protection levee systems for New Orleans. Does all that sound familiar? Well, 40 years after Hurricane Betsy, another storm, Katrina, would take a similar path through South Florida on her way to devastating New Orleans. That storm sent the National Flood Insurance Program billions of dollars into debt, debt that totals $25 billion today. So how to work out that debt and not get further behind? Those are among the issues as the National Flood Insurance Program faces a legislative deadline. The program is due to expire on September 30th unless Congress reauthorizes it.
Congress has to renew that, otherwise the economy in the United States pretty much shuts down.
That's Don Dresbach, Executive Vice President of the Beacon Group, an insurance brokerage in Boca Raton.
Because anyone who's located in a special hazard area wouldn't be able to qualify for federally guaranteed loans. And homeowners, you couldn't sell any homes. They're located in those areas. You couldn't resell. You couldn't sell anything new that's located in those special hazard areas. So it would pretty much shut down business and real estate.
He says it nonchalantly, but it is the worst case scenario here. Since flood insurance is required for most mortgages, you wouldn't be able to buy or sell homes or condos if they're located in certain designated flood zones. But it is a scenario Roy Wright is determined to avoid. Wright is the director of the National Flood Insurance Program.
Across the board, I hear a clear commitment to a multi-year on-time reauthorization of this program. Full stop. I think there's across the board, everyone agrees on that. I think the question then is just working against the clock. How do we work through the dimensions? I would anticipate that the House will go first with their work, and we'll see how quickly they move. The engagement that I have seen on both sides of the aisle at the member level, not just at the staff, is very high. And it's been very constructive. And I'm optimistic we will see a reasonable bill that can move through in a bipartisan way.
Is enough being done to encourage private flood insurance into the market, in your opinion?
I think that's an important part of this reauthorization. We need, you know, if I take a few paces back, yes, I direct the National Flood Insurance Program, but I'm a leader in the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And the broader public policy objective is we need people covered for the flood peril. We know that folks who have flood insurance recover more quickly and more fully than those who do not. We know that plain and clear. And so, yes, I have a responsibility for the National Flood Insurance Program, but I actually want to see the flood cover continue to expand all across the country, and the private markets have to be part of that process. We must put ourselves in a position by which there is private capital and private acceptance of the risk in order for us to expand that coverage across the country.
Will that require eliminating the non-compete clause right now of private insurers that work through the National Flood Insurance Program at FEMA to offer that coverage, to be able to offer separate but competing coverage with that private capital?
So there's a fair amount of debate about the non-compete clause. I think it's important to note that the non-compete clause is set on the company, not on the agent. And agents can sell whatever they choose to do.
But it's the company that's taking the financial risk that's doing the underwriting.
Absolutely true. But you can look, and I've interacted with companies in Florida where they've got a subsidiary that is a write-your-own company under the National Flood Insurance Program. They have another division that writes excess and surplus lines. And they have another division that may be an admitted carrier that's writing some kind of flood endorsement. And that's absolutely allowed. They just do it through three different entities under their broader umbrella.
The reform effort that's been put forth so far also aims to clear up any kind of ambiguity regarding mortgage companies accepting that private capital flood insurance policy. Do you think the reform effort as proposed today here in late May goes far enough to give those mortgage companies the clearance to say, yes, you can accept essentially private capital flood insurance?
We need to have clarity in the law so that anyone who has appropriate coverages through the private markets is shown appropriate credit towards meeting those requirements with their mortgage. We absolutely agree with that.
And how about caps on repetitive losses? Critics of the program will say, you know, you get a flood that comes through, a 1 in 100, 1 in 500 year flood, whatever it may be. And flood insurance just encourages folks to rebuild in those areas and refile losses when more water comes through in future years. Should the reform effort be more aggressive on capping repetitive losses for those policy owners?
So I'm going to agree with you in part, but let me pull out a nuance first. I don't know that I would agree with you related to the incentives that you described and tried to set up. That said, by law today, I have a mandate to offer insurance. No matter how many losses you have, I'm required to still offer it to you. And at the House Financial Services Committee hearing, I had a dialogue that went along with Chairman Hinserling where I agreed. I do think there needs to be limits put in place. And the Congress can decide where that's at. Is it at 150% or 200% of policy limits? But by the time that we've paid out claims at that level of excess, you either need to take the grant for an acquisition to be bought out of the high hazard zone, or you need to be on your own. That needs to be a choice that you make. And we should not continue to pay these larger claims that go on and on and on. And I think as we look at repetitive loss, we need to understand the couple dimensions of it. You know, so we can have a repetitive loss where there have been two or three $2,500 claims. That's one kind of repetitive loss, and I have concerns about it. I've got a much higher degree of concern on a home that may be worth $800,000 or $900,000, and they keep filing claims at policy limits, so they keep getting paid that $250,000. Those are the ones that I find particularly egregious And I do hope Congress gives us the authority to take the appropriate action and tell those folks, you need to buy on the private market. You need to be on your own. You should not be benefiting from the National Flood Insurance Program.
While most years the program is financially solvent, Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and Superstorm Sandy in 2012 required it to borrow billions of dollars, and it's still paying those dollars back. It had to borrow another $1.6 billion in January, partly because of Hurricane Matthew and the inland flooding in Louisiana last summer. Hurricane Andrew in 1992 and Hurricane Wilma in 2005, while causing lots of damage here in South Florida, are not among the top 10 most expensive flood events for the program. Yet Florida has the most value at risk. $386 billion worth of Florida property is protected by federally backed flood insurance policies. More than 99% of flood insurance in Florida comes through the national program. The private flood insurance market is very, very small. According to the state's Office of Insurance Regulation, fewer than 10,000 flood insurance policies were written by private insurers last year. While that's a 10 times increase from a year earlier, it's still just a fraction of the almost 2 million properties using the taxpayer-backed system. Still to come, moving out of a flood zone without moving at all.
Well, we've had high tides to come up over the docks, but never any flooding. Just a little bit of water above the docks. Sometimes it spills over over the curb, but nothing into the building areas.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. It's Flooding and Finance today. I'm Tom Hudson. It was a gorgeous May day when I went to meet Molly Curry in her condominium complex in Fort Lauderdale. It was midday, the sun was beating down, the sky was that South Florida brilliant blue, with a few wispy clouds here and there floating by. It was hot and getting hotter. The Bay Colony Club is a big complex with 20 separate buildings housing one and two bedroom condos behind a guardhouse. The buildings are two stories, brick, painted white, with small screened-in porches for the units. Every half dozen buildings or so sits a recreation center, each one with a swimming pool. We were meeting at the second rec center. Under a long awning outside were a few bicycles locked up. The tennis courts were quiet and just a couple of people were lounging along the pool deck.
Hi, how are you? Molly?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
How are you?
Tom Hudson, it's nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Nice to put a voice with a
face.
Thank
you.
I was meeting Molly to talk about flood insurance. She submitted a question to our Palm Readers Project. That's our public power journalism project where you can ask questions you want us to explore. Molly's question was as succinct as it is pertinent.
My question was, who or what agency determines flood zones? How often are they updated? And what is the criteria to determine a flood zone?
Molly's condominium association is just one of the more than 750,000 properties with flood insurance in South Florida. The mortgage on her condo requires that she carry flood insurance because of the flood zone designation of her neighborhood.
I had received a letter from my mortgage company stating that they would no longer need a flood assessment from my association, that I was no longer in a flood zone.
What did you think when you opened up that letter?
Wow. How did this happen? Who made the decision? Is this going to lower my security costs? I mean, a lot of questions.
Now, flood zones will do that. There is an alphabet soup of classifications. Molly's condo complex had been rated AE. A zones have a high potential of flooding. That means there's a 1% chance of flooding each year and a 26% chance of flooding over the course of a 30-year mortgage. Being in an A zone means you're in a special flood hazard area. That's a general description for several designations.
Well, we've had high tides to come up over the docks, but never any flooding. Just a little bit of water above the docks. Sometimes it spills over over the curb. But nothing into the building areas.
That's part of the reason why she sent us her questions when her mortgage company told her she did not need flood insurance any longer. As for that first question,
who or what agency determines flood zones?
So FEMA does the analysis.
That's Roy Wright, who's in charge of the National Flood Insurance Program under the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Sometimes by ourselves, oftentimes with local partners, local public works agencies or water management districts, to draw the lines of the special flood hazard area. They are then adopted after local review by the land use authority that is in place.
So it's the Federal Emergency Management Agency who is the primary agency determining flood zones. But its word is not necessarily the final word on whether your property is in a federally designated flood zone.
We have ways to revise those maps.
FEMA revises those flood zone maps, quote, when new and more accurate information becomes available, according to its own guidelines. In 2009, FEMA updated its flood zone maps used to determine flood insurance rates in Miami-Dade County. It did the same in Broward County in 2014, and Palm Beach County expects to see new flood insurance rate maps this fall. That means today's flood zone may not have been the same just a few years ago in the cases of Miami-Dade and Broward, or the same as what it will be in a few months in the case of Palm Beach County. So back to our conversation with Roy Wright, head of the National Flood Insurance Program. Are there lessons learned in reassessment of areas with a high concentration of flood policies that folks that are bracing or preparing for an assessment can learn from?
There is. So first and foremost, we need to understand that FEMA needs the best data possible to inform our process. And usually the local government has those data. They're best positioned to inform us where the structures are, the nature of the ground elevations, and the various kinds of projects they may have in place related to flood control. What we have learned is moving through the mapping process, we need to make sure that the local elected officials are fully apprised of the process and where we're going. Because at the end of the day, they have to vote. So even if we've been working at the staff level, that's not enough. And then we honestly need to take a couple of different paths because, you know, I see as many structures move into the special flood hazard area as come out in any given year. So if I have a map where I have hundreds or maybe a couple of thousand structures coming out, I want them to understand that while they may no longer be in that mandatory purchase, they may not be just inside that 1% exceedance line, they're still at flood risk. And they should have flood insurance, and that should be priced far lower. They should be getting a preferred risk policy because they have a medium level of risk as opposed to the high hazard. When I'm working with a community that is seeing an increase of dozens or hundreds or maybe even thousands of structures, this is a point by which the engagement needs to be broad-based. Individual homeowners want to understand why this is happening, what informed it. They want to understand the credibility behind it. They want to know what options they have. And they want to understand what it means in terms of the price.
In Palm Beach County, those changes are coming. FEMA has released preliminary rezones. It's the first new map for Palm Beach in 30 years, and there are considerable changes. For example, Palm Beach International Airport only has two small areas considered in flood zones today. In the proposed map, flood zones dot the airport between runways. Now, there are areas in western Palm Beach County that are due to be reclassified as flood zones, and that could force property owners, if they have a mortgage, to buy flood insurance. But it's the opposite for Molly Curry, the Fort Lauderdale condo owner who learned from her mortgage company that she no longer needed flood insurance. It wasn't the federal government, though, who determined her property no longer was at a heightened risk. It was her condominium association board and the guy it hired to appeal its flood zone rating. So still to come, the second part of Molly's question and the man who helped change her flood zone.
What is the criteria to determine a flood zone?
Basically, the technology is driving the next generation of maps.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, Flooding and Finance. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
So this is the turn in the L-shaped canal going out to the intercoastal. And right here, the water will, during high tides, king tides, the water will come up to the docks and over it and spill a little bit in sometimes in, over the curb.
Driving around Molly Curry's condominium complex in Fort Lauderdale, it's obvious she's proud of her neighborhood. She lives in the Bay Colony Condominiums. She's owned a condo here since 2000 when she moved in with her two school-age daughters. They're adults now and no longer live with her, but Molly's stuck around and loves her complex.
What's the tour for the Winterfest tour? Comes through here. Winterfest comes through here.
She used to work for a company providing software to auto dealerships. Now at 60 years old, she's starting a new career as an entrepreneur. She's starting her own business connecting companies doing business with car dealers, like websites, marketing services, and media. She's bootstrapping it herself from her condominium, the same one her mortgage company says no longer needs flood insurance. And that sparked her question to our Palm Readers Project.
What is the criteria to determine a flood zone?
Molly's condo association had been buying flood insurance because it was in a flood zone that mortgage lenders required coverage. But in March, she got a letter from her mortgage company saying that she no longer needed it. So what happened? Brent Spencer happened.
I'm Brent Spencer. I'm a licensed surveyor in Pompano Beach, Florida.
Spencer's company is Florida Flood Zone Services. What he does for a living is work with owners to reclassify their properties out of special flood hazard areas, the designation that requires flood insurance if you have a mortgage.
With my work, we were able to actually challenge the flood zone and get it officially in the Flood Zone X, which lenders will not require the flood insurance.
Walk me through, Brent, the process. At what point were you brought in, and what's the work like that you have to do in order to get to that result?
So basically, part of my review is the building was in a flood zone, but physically the building was above the flood level. If it ever would flood to the FEMA flood level, it never will touch the buildings. So that's why it qualified for the FEMA program.
Now, to be fair, these buildings date back to the early to mid-70s. The buildings haven't been raised up at all. There doesn't seem to be any dikes that are around surrounding the property at all. What's changed for the designation to change?
Well, it's more or less the technology. So the last generation of maps for the Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach were in the 1980s and 1990s. So it's more or less the technology has evolved so much that now there's more data for them to remap it and correctly or more precisely determine the flood risk.
And that's what happened with Molly's condo complex. The buildings had been designated Flood Zone AE as recently as 2014 when FEMA updated flood maps in Broward County. The AE zone means mandatory flood insurance if you have a mortgage. But Spencer's work showed the buildings themselves were above the base flood elevation for Molly's complex. That allowed the Federal Emergency Management Agency to issue what's called a Letter of Map Amendment, or LOMA, L-O-M-A. It's the official redesignation of a property's flood zone. I sat with Molly and Brent Spencer inside one of the rec centers of Molly's complex looking at FEMA maps of her neighborhood.
Molly, we are in front of three different vintage maps that Brent has brought along with us. One from the year 2000, one from 2014, and one from 2016-2017. Do you see your building on these maps?
Sure.
And what kind of zones is it in here from 2000 and 2014?
Well, this early map is, oh, you got it, Brent? Okay, the early map, it's very basic. So it's kind of hard to see, you know, exactly what this means to me. When I get into the 2014, now it's much clearer. I can see all the properties across the canal. I can see exactly where my building is, and even these little blue dips into the building doesn't make sense to me because I've never had water to come anywhere near my front door. And then the more detailed maps are fantastic. This makes a lot of sense to me that we've never had serious problems here, even during all the big storms that we've had. So a lot of, much more detailed in the earlier maps.
Brent, do these three maps represent that evolution of the data collection that FEMA uses. As we look at the most recent map, what does it tell you about Molly's building and her association?
Well, basically through the ages of the maps, it's the technology. So basically the 90s map was archaic, and then the one that this came out with in 2014 kind of purely more represents the actual elevations and the flooding of that area. And then the digital maps are more of a visual aid for lenders and insurance agents and all that to zoom in and actually physically look at that building. And it may be one little corner of a building touching the flood zone, and if that's true, then the lender will require flood insurance.
What I see when I'm looking at the most recent version of this map, the digitized version of it, we're along a canal, a series of condominium buildings with several units in each building, the flood zone showing the blue from the canal spilling over into the lawn, spilling in between the buildings into the roads here in the association, but then islands of orange. And the islands of orange are the buildings themselves. Brent, does that mean no need for flood insurance?
Right. No, the orange is the flood zone X, so that means it's not a flood zone.
Molly, how do these maps make you feel about your threat to floods based upon your experience, which has been no water?
I don't see any threat. And we're surrounded by, not surrounded, but we're on a L-shaped canal and out to the intercoastal. So very encouraging.
And it's because of better technology. To Molly's question about the criteria for a flood zone, the criteria hasn't really changed necessarily. It's the technology measuring landscapes figuring out the risk to flood waters.
Molly, what do you think of the answer of the criteria for flood zones? That it's not necessarily the criteria is changing, it's just the technology allows for better measurement.
Right. So that means that as we get better with the technology, we'll have even more information, especially if there is any kind of climate change impact that's going to be happening in the area. The better the technology, the more information we have, and the better decisions we'll be able to make.
Brent, how about that? We do live in a community that is experiencing sea level rise. How does that fall into the equation of flood insurance in your experience?
That will be the next generation of maps. So they'll slowly increase it, and basically the only good thing is a grandfathering. So you can stay with the flood zone you're at now, and you won't have to be forced to use the new flood maps. So it's when the next generation maps come out, you probably need to look at them ahead of schedule to make sure you get a policy before it happens.
The grandfathering would benefit a property that is going to be reclassified into a worse off flood zone, right?
Correct.
Which brings us back to the financial friction with the National Flood Insurance Program, the ability of some property owners to keep paying lower flood insurance rates that do not accurately reflect the financial risk to the American taxpayer. Molly sent us her questions about flood zones through Palm Readers. What are you curious about regarding the South Florida economy? You can submit those questions at WLRN.org/palmreaders. Pilar Uribe is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.